back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and we can be found on all the streaming platforms, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, and more. I am slowly but surely uploading these episodes to my YouTube channel, which is L.Ariel. And we're also online at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We're all about careers in the music industry. If you are new, welcome. Make yourself at home. We're all about talking to the movers and shakers and innovators in the industry today, just hearing all about their experiences, their trials and tribulations. We're really blessed and grateful that they can share with us all their insights and everything that's been going on with them in their careers, and that they can share with you and make your path maybe a little bit easier and a little bit wiser. Last week, I had the immense, immense pleasure of talking with Graham Cochran, who is the founder and CEO of Recording Revolution. RecordingRevolution.com and YouTube channel is completely exploded. His basic motive when he started was to offer tutorials to friends and people that wanted to mix and record and thought that they'd have to get thousands and thousands of dollars of studio equipment. And he was really all about showing how you can mix and record on a budget, and that it's not rocket science, and that it is accessible. And this little business he started as a little blog, just, you know, trying to support his family, has just completely exploded. He's really made a name for himself. His YouTube channel is completely taken off. So definitely go check him out, recordingrevolution.com. And the interview is posted online everywhere. Really, really great stuff. So be sure and check that out. And go back and check out all the episodes while you're at it. This week, I am very pleased to welcome to the podcast stage Monty Malone, Senior Vice President of A&R Worldwide. A&R Worldwide is a world-renowned platform specializing in music, media, and technology in support of global emerging talent. Monty is a musician. He's been a roadie. He's been a studio engineer and producer. He was also art director for the Album Network, which was an industry publication that went to all the radio stations and record labels. He was VP New Media at SMC Recordings, helping to push hyphy, rap, and hip-hop and those emerging artists to the forefront. He has known all the machinations behind the scenes. He knows how the sausage is made, ladies and gentlemen, and he has lived to tell the tale. He's got incredible knowledge and experience, and I am delighted that he put up with me for the better part of almost an hour in order to share it with all of you. Unfortunately, as much as I nagged him, he did not provide a track from his band back in the day, but he did share one of his favorite tracks, the Bee Gees' Nights on Broadway, and this is a slamming track. Take a listen. Joining me on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am so happy that you could join me today.
It's my pleasure.
Yay. So let's talk about your childhood.
Which part? The good, the bad, or the ugly?
No, you can just share about music. I love to hear what's your first exposure to music, that kind of thing.
Well, I don't really come from an esteemed musical family, even though music was very much a part of our everyday life from listening to music. My mom played the piano and sang. My dad, he had an organ that had like really cool, like little beats and samba things that you would press buttons and be able to play the organ to. And then my older siblings got into guitar and guitar lessons. And I was the youngest and the lone wolf, and I got into drums. And
nice.
So we never had a family band, even though that would have been very cool. But from a very early age, I did learn a bit of piano, a little bit of guitar, but drums was what I was really interested in. And was very fortunate enough, even for its time, to be able to play in a concert band, even in elementary school, where it was kind of a district concert fan, so it wasn't just my school. So I'd go to rehearsals and learn, like, the rudiments and, you know, measures and beats and timing and everything. And then in junior high, I continued with concert band, but then got into marching band. So I was in drums. And then high school, I was in drumline. So drums was pretty much my entry point into the quote-unquote music. And then good old AM Gold, listening to radio in its heyday with my mom, driving around to, you know, anything from Streisand to Captain and Tennille, the Bee Gees, and all the, you know, cool top 40 of its time in between, that really inspired me, I guess, dream. Mm-hmm. And we were also pretty fortunate enough at the elementary school that I went to. I went to school in Southern California. I grew up in Orange County, and in the school district, we had people that would visit with, like, music lessons. So you would, you know, you would play blocks, or you would play the kazoo or stuff to, like, music that they were doing. But what was cool was he was doing pop music of what was current at the time. So it, you know, really inspired me to follow along with music.
Right. And marching bands and drum lines, like, that actually takes a hell of a lot of coordination, because you're, like, moving around and doing formations and all that stuff, right?
Definitely. And it taught me everything that I know to this day. And I'm very lucky to have that experience from the practice and getting up early, zero period, after school, traveling, having your act together to be able to perform with a large group. As you said, the marching, staying in time, the look, the uniform, being sharp, and paying attention to what others are doing as a collective unit and not about yourself. And then doing the side thing with the drum line, which was cool because we even won state for your best in California.
Wow.
And again, that was a whole other experience of just trying to put on an entire show just through rudiments, beats, and sounds that drums make, and, you know, all the little fancy maneuvers in between. But again, it taught me a lot about what it takes, you know, and that's the tenacity, practice, showing up, and putting in the time and effort to make something special.
Nice. Did you play in any sort of high school formed bands outside of school, or?
With my friends, of course. We had, like, our little, you know, ghetto garage bands that never really had any names, but, you know, we would jam out riffs or certain, you know, current songs and sing and mess around and do, like, little New Year's Eve gigs, you know, just to, you know, annoy the neighbor type of things, but nothing that was too serious of, you know, trying to form any type of commercial entity or band. I never really had that aspiration, never thought about it. Like I said, I was so, from a young age of performing with an ensemble or with a school or a concert type of setting, that I, as far as, like, a mainstream type of band thought, just never really crossed my mind, even though I was a fan of music and loved music. And especially diverse kind of music, because, you know, growing up in the 80s, you know, with the exposure of, like, hip-hop, punk, heavy metal, all the pop and R&B that was happening, and even the mainstream country at the time was very crossover. And so we had quite a very cool, unique pool of music to play in, so to speak. But and again, having great radio here in Southern California with, like, K-Rock and this station from San Diego, 91X, being there in the middle in Orange County, and then influenced by this station that was called the Mighty 690. It was an AM station out of Tijuana, Mexico.
Oh, wow.
That played, like, all the cool, like, stuff. You know, that's, like, the first time I heard, like, Blondie or the Ramones or certain other cool acts. And like I said, all that exposure was there, but I just never thought about forming a band. That came much quote unquote, later in like high school, where I got introduced to physically like to bands.
Interesting too. I'm assuming the radio stations back then were pretty independent too. It wasn't like big conglomerate ownership at that time.
They may have been, but you didn't think of it. It wasn't. Obviously, there was no internet, so there was no way to research or care. And all you knew is that they played great music. And the radio DJs really had their own unique sets and connection to the audience. And they were at the pulse and forefront of what was happening. I mean, you know, I look back, someone was, a friend of mine is doing a show here in Los Angeles with this LA band called The Missing Persons. And was showing them, because they weren't that familiar with them, and I was showing them how big they were in the 80s. And
called the
Us Festival, which was actually funded by Apple, which a lot of people didn't know that, but it was a huge festival out in Glen Helen. And with all these acts that were on the verge, but like at the time, they weren't really, you know, super mainstream. They were, you know, the early dawning of like alternative acts, but it was like The Police, Missing Persons, Oingo Boingo, The Clash, Men at Work, all these cool bands. And, you know, a lot of that was driven from the radio station.
That's pretty great. So what happened after high school? What direction did you want to go in?
Well, I had two choices because I wasn't very, you know, scholarly in school. And my parents are pretty, you know, regular blue collar types. That my dad, he worked more in like the oil industry, and my mom, she worked at an aerospace company. And I was either gonna go to school to be an auto mechanic, which I did, and my passion was still music, but at that time, again, we're not really having any friends or family in the business. I really didn't know there was a business or a way to make money. But at the end of high school, I had started being a roadie for a band. And so literally a week after I graduated high school, I hit the road with a band. And we drove all over the western half of America with me being, I was only 16 when I graduated high school, and drove all over the place with this band called Naked Soul. And got to really see what rock and roll was, and be a part of something that I thought was, you know, exciting and new, and got to be a part of their early success. They had gotten signed to an independent label called Scotty Brothers, and they had like Weird Al Yankovic and the band Survivor that had the song Eye of the Tiger in the Rocky movies. Anyways, I got to see firsthand, you know, that experience, and I loved it, you know, as far as seeing like the where the rubber meets the road with load-ins, load-outs, playing shows, rehearsing, writing songs, going into studios. So I saw that, but I never saw it as a career. So I did go, and I was an auto mechanic by day, but by night I was working with bands, and then got into studio work as far as like engineering and stuff like that, and recording, and also dabbled into radio, because then I was going to night school at Fullerton. I went to Cal State Fullerton, so got into radio, got into a little bit of television production. And all along, I was still working with the bands, and I don't know how much I should keep going on. I mean, I can go on forever talking about like that stuff, but that's pretty much what I did right out of high school was, you know, I kind of had a day job, but at night was going to night school and working with bands and learning all along.
Yeah, I mean, that I have to say that's really interesting, though, because, again, there's like a ton of things you could have done after your day job. You know what I mean? But literally right out of high school, boom, you were a roadie with a band. So obviously there was a thread. There was a trajectory happening right there, even if you were, you know, sort of being sensible or like, you know, this is not going to be a career or whatever. What made you decide? So at Fullerton, were you taking classes for TV and radio?
Yeah, I was taking communication courses and specializing in audio engineering, because that was just something that kind of went hand in hand with what I had seen with roadieing with bands. And then also at that time, I was lucky enough to be friends with this band called Dramarama, that was big on K-Rock with their song Anything Anything. And so I was road managing with them and recording with them in studios. Like I said, it just, everything started to evolve, but I just, again, I didn't see a career or a path. To me, it was still just having fun, creating music with my friends, and going along for the ride. And that's pretty much how I spent most of my early to late 20s, was just going along for the ride before I got a little bit more serious, involved in the actual industry of music.
Yeah, but it's funny, you know, we were just talking right before the call about relationships. Like, obviously, though, you were forming these relationships early on, and I assumed each one led to the next.
You're 100% correct, but again, call it being naive or humble or both, I didn't see it as relationships. To me, they were literally just friends, and to me, there was no dots being connected. There was no stepping stone. There was no plan. There was no higher purpose for those connections outside of making music, and this person happens to be another engineer or a producer or a booking agent or whatever like that. To me, it wasn't a contact. It was just another piece of the puzzle.
Right.
But I didn't see that the puzzle was being formed until much later in my life to actually see all the pieces coming together to where I am today.
Absolutely. But, you know, I mean, and I think that that is a testament to, you know, being humble. And I think that's great, too. And I think the other way we could just simply word it is you followed your passion and everything kind of fell into place.
Luckily, yes. but it wasn't quite as easy as nothing really fell in. I mean, it was a very long, difficult, arduous road of blood, sweat, and tears, because there was definitely no fast track to success. I also had no trajectory or aim for it. Again, it was always just going along for the ride, so to speak. That's what I felt, because I was always hanging out with older people that were mentoring me. But I didn't see it as that. To me, it was just a bond and a friendship, and me being at the right place at the right time, but without any type of self-interference, shall we say.
So when did you start getting quote-unquote serious? Was it after you graduated, or did an opportunity come up? Like, what? How did that happen?
Well, surprisingly, the bass player in the band Dramarama, his day job was working at this place called the Album Network, which was an industry trade publication that kind of focused on radio trends, new releases, who was getting signed, all the various players in the music business, specifically radio and labels. And we also had our own charts. And the Album Network had a bunch of different subsidiaries underneath it. Album Network was kind of the flagship magazine, and underneath that was like the Network 40, Urban Network, Virtual Alternative, Agro, which was like metal, Totally Adult, which was like adult contemporary and stuff. And together we formed a team, and the bass player said, "Hey, there's a job opening here." And I go, "Great." You know, because I didn't really have a full-time gig at the time and was just kind of knocking around. And he's like, "But it's in the mailroom. Do you even know what that is?" And I had no idea really what that was or what it would entail. But I definitely jumped in with both feet, and honestly became my first real full-time job working in the music industry. And I'm so happy that I started in that way, because it really was the epicenter of all things creative within the organization. Everyone would come in from all the different facets and talk about their needs, wants, you know, telling funny stories. You know, we would help them all in different areas and aspects, personally and professionally, and really got to feel the pulse of the entire operation. And from that, then I went into more of their graphic end of the job, and I was an art director for their Top 40 magazine, and then got into the actual layout and production of the magazine itself.
Wow.
That's where kind of more of my creative side got to come out with, you know, the covers, the various stories that we had laid out, and the pictures and the fonts and imagery and the vibe and style of the magazine came together. And I got to work with a lot of very talented graphic designers and artists. And this was at a time before digital production, so we were printing film and doing four-color process to print. So It was quite the experience to learn that. But then I got to work with all the various writers, editors, collecting all the information and getting it to the artists and seeing how that came together. And then just because of the workflow, all the advertising that was in the magazine was all label-related for, like, the new releases. And at that time, it was when Top 40 was really, you know, at its forefront. So it was all the NSYNCs, Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera's, Pink, you name it, that I was working with. And so I was working with their promotion departments, getting the updated text for the magazines on a weekly basis of where the record was being spun. So I got to learn a lot about the various radio formats and the station call letters and layout of the ad, of what's important, and dealing directly with record labels. So then that was my next step after that, was working more with labels after I left the magazine.
How long were you with the magazine?
Almost 7 years. I mean, it was a place.
So you worked your way up from the mailroom up to art director in this magazine.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct.
And everything was learned on the job.
Correct. And that's also where I met my boss today, Sat Bissell. Is he worked for their magazine called Virtually Alternative. And we became fast friends and have been together for over 20 years.
Wow, that's so great. So what was the distribution like? I'm just curious about this with this magazine. Was it like a worldwide circulation or?
We did a little bit of international, but it was direct mail. It wasn't really a subscription because it wasn't really for the public, even though a little bit of the public read it. So it wasn't like on newsstands, but it was front desk stuff for labels, radio stations, and people in media to know what was happening. And behind the scenes, we were working hand in hand with promoting the records and the promotion departments from the labels and getting behind the acts and really being a champion of these bands and helping break bands with our relationships.
Is it one of those things where you kind of like you saw how the sausage was made, like how certain artists were being promoted, et cetera, et cetera? Like, was it sort of a enlightening moment about kind of the music industry, seeing all the sort of machinations and everybody behind the scenes that create a star, so to speak? I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about that.
That's actually quite a brilliant question, because you're 100% correct. I got to literally see exactly how the entertainment industry works, not just the music industry, because with the magazine and what public perception is and what reality is are two different worlds, and especially when, on a commercial sense. And I got to see the many aspects of the business, from the promotional angle to the radio angle to even the A&R angle, because a lot of these guys would come in early with their projects, the stuff that they had just signed to introduce them to us, to get kind of a litmus test of what we felt. So we got to meet like people like Eminem and Kid Rock and so many others, John Mayer, Avril Lavigne, before they even put out a record.
Wow.
And kind of exciting times to see how these people were and how they evolved, and to hear like their early records before anyone else did, to get our opinions and stuff. So I got a really good fast track education on almost the entire music business outside of publishing, in regards to like music collecting, working at the Album Network.
Do you have any just sort of insight you want to share about that in terms of people's perception of artists versus what it's really about?
Again, I mean, I personally don't mind explaining some of that stuff, but also there is a bit of je ne sais quoi and a bit of mystique that I think is important for everybody involved, even for myself, even though I have seen the inner workings of the robot. Sometimes you want to believe that it's real. And there's really no point in me explaining some of that stuff, because again, the truth be told, even with all of the magic wands and things that are out there, the judge and jury is still the fans.
Yeah.
And the judge and jury is still the people that listen. You can't purchase fans, and you cannot buy people's playlist on their own personal side. You can buy them, you know, on various streaming services, but you can't buy their personal playlist. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that's a great point. And also in the age of people buying Twitter followers and Facebook likes, et cetera.
It's no different than a lot of industries. It's just in entertainment, you know, we want to believe that these actors or these musicians and people are the people that we see on screen. And then when their real life portrays out in the gossip magazines, then it kind of shatters our whole thing. So for me to kind of explain some of the inner workings and things of what I've been exposed to or what I'm privy to, it's really no benefit to anybody. You know what I mean? It's just, it is what it is.
Yeah. And I really like your point about the fans. It's like when at the end of the day, that's what speaks the truth. Yeah.
And to be really honest, I mean, because I was also fortunate enough, I kind of glossed over that I was an artist myself, you know, towards the end of the 90s, I did form my own band and did have a decent amount of success. And I got to be courted by all the major labels, got to do the Warped Tour, and got to play lots of shows all over the western part of the United States, and got to make records and all that cool stuff. And, you know, ultimately, it still really boils down to the music, the songs, and the fans. And no amount of promotion and magic from some of the people in the industry or A&R types will really take that away. Even though they are a part of the success and are a part of the story, they're not the ones that are creating that emotional connection that is sacred between an artist and a fan.
Can you talk a little bit more about the band? What was the name of your band?
It was a band called Ghetto Lust, and thankfully, this was pre-major internet stuff, so you will not pictures. You will not see any pictures of me or video of me or things. But we were honestly kind of at the forefront of that whole rap rock, Sublime type of style of music, and got to play with a lot of great bands and formed some incredible relationships and worked with some great musicians. And again, until you've been in that position where you're writing your own music, recording it, producing it, releasing it, coming up with covers, track listings, marketing, promotion, booking shows, and keeping the unit of a band together, you really have no idea what it's like. And it's kind of a sensitive thing, and not to really take anything away from a lot of talented people that are in the entertainment and music industry, but unfortunately, from my perspective, having come from the ranks that I did and all the things we've talked about, it is a bit upsetting to me of what's become of a lot of things and how things have been driven by a lot of technology companies that are really, you know, in my opinion, capitalizing off of all the hard work and effort that a lot of musicians and talented, dedicated veterans of the music industry have created. And then because they created a clever app or a clever transaction, then now we're being forced into utilizing that service. And bands that are emerging are so desperate for attention and so desperate to be noticed that they've jumped from one thing to the next. You know, at first it was all about MySpace, and it became all about Facebook, and then it became all about Twitter, and then it became all about Snapchat, then it became all about Instagram, then it became all about YouTube, then it became all about Spotify. You know, and what if you're to follow that path, all that really happened was the artists and the people that were playing the Pied Piper with these audiences, all they did was jump from technology to technology that wasn't very different, and they brought their mass audiences with them and made all these tech companies very influential and very rich.
That's a good point. And I think it is sort of born of desperation.
Correct.
That it's sort of trying to get immediate gratification, and then the end shot is that you've essentially made someone else really, really rich out of your content, your created content.
But most of that is because somebody is trying to go online, not to name any platform, it doesn't matter what platform. Mm-hmm. Someone is trying to go online to connect with an audience, and someone from the audience is trying to connect with somebody that is creating something that moves them, and that's all that's really happening. And in the past, it used to be more through live performances or through emails or message boards or literally from picking up the phone. Like when I had my band, we had our own phone number for the band, and we would leave messages about upcoming gigs or leave a message, and people would leave us crazy messages and stuff. But
I love that. That's so cool.
It's just an emotional connection. You're just trying to connect.
Right.
And to me, the whole mindset of a lot of these technology companies, I don't think any of them are evil. It has nothing to do with that. It's just they're capitalizing on a animal emotion that we all have, and that's to connect and to feel like you're part of something. And then some people that are good at it, they know how to manipulate their audience or fans or friends into coming back and to evangelize what they're doing and to increase the likes, to increase the streams, to increase the shares, to increase the things, all so that they can feel rewarded by the band, by their attention.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's like, what is really going on here?
Yeah.
You know, and I think some of that stuff has started to backfire on some of these artists that have gotten into that game of deception and manipulation with not only their numbers, but also with their audience and fans. Like, nothing will still take the place of mystique and putting out great music and doing great live performances. You can create all of the clever tricks and clicks in the world, but it's going to be short-lived, you know?
Yeah. It's sort of like, okay, again, that instant gratification, but what about the long-term? The fans that, you know, they want to see authenticity, they want to see... Go ahead.
Not to step on what you're saying, but the fans are going to grow up.
Yeah.
Adults don't do that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, adults don't spend their time online evangelizing fans and looking for attention and begging for, you know, other people to like a band that they're friends of, so that way they can try to get a free concert ticket or whatever else, which is all great. It's all clever. There's always been promotions, but all that stuff is very short-lived. And that can, you know, I don't know what your follow-up question is, but segue into something that I'm passionate about is, you know, a massive underserved market, which is the Generation X, where, you know, a lot of us have a lot more disposable income. We did grow up in a technology generation with the first computers being in our schools and being the first people to really buy into, social media and everything else. And our market is being underserved in regards to festivals, in regards to new artists, new albums. And to me, that's something that definitely, to me, is an open opportunity for the right and clever person that's looking to make money and not in it for the fashion.
Right. So let's pivot a little bit about the record label side. You got into that.
Sure.
Was that like after the band stuff, or what? What was the timeline on that? After the magazine? The
timeline on that would have been after the magazine. I had gotten sober. from my trials and tribulations of dealing with the industry and being in a band, decided to move to San Francisco because an opportunity had presented itself. And I started working for a hip hop label that was called SMC Recordings. And we put out about 60 releases in about 2 years. It was through Universal and Fontana Distribution, which became InGrooves. And we were their number one urban label, selling millions of records worldwide.
And then how long was that tenure for? How long were you doing that for? It was a two-year...
it was about like 2004 to about 2007. What the actual timeline was, and we're pretty proud of a lot of the things that we did because there was a big scene that was created called hyphy hip hop, and we had all the best rappers that represented that, from Keek the Sneak to Mr. Fab, Sam Quinn, Messy Marv, Juice, and the whole other subgenres of that, but we were very successful. We had stuff on radio. We had features on MTV, videos on MTV. They even did like a whole, like a snapshot with MTV coming out to the Bay Area from all the stuff that was going on with like the sideshows and the cars and the ghost riding your whip and everything that was being created out of this genre of music that we were at the forefront of.
What was your role there at the label?
I was the vice president of the production, working right alongside the A&R department and the head of the label. And technically, there was only about four of us that worked at this label. And so we all wore very many hats. My job was to ensure that the releases were set, they were on time and delivered from the production of the record, the final masterings of the records, the artwork, and the quantities that we were shipping to the street, and helping create like the one sheets for the bands and the overall marketing plan and what we were doing with the bands alongside this very brilliant kid named Will Bronson, who now is the manager of the band Run the Jewels. So a lot of cool things happened out of there, and very proud of the work that we did.
That's great. What, now you were 2004, 2007. So obviously, like speaking of technology, like online, that was really starting to kind of explode. How did that affect, how did that affect you guys at the label and doing promotion and that type of thing?
These questions are magic because it affected it tremendously. And that was something that I'm proud that I brought a lot to the table because I was there when Facebook first started, obviously was a fan of MySpace. And a lot of these gangster rappers were definitely not online. I'll say that right now. They were mostly in prison or making records. What we did was we started up their websites, and we started up their social profiles, and we ran them, meaning myself. And many times I would act as the artist themselves and making posts or answering simple questions. But every now and then we'd get some pretty interesting questions or comments or things that where I got to really see the emotional connection that their fans were having with the artist. And obviously all these things were conveyed because we were very much a street record company, meaning that we were very much a part of the scene and what our artists were doing. And they were very involved in the label itself and coming in, not just for meetings, but just hanging out. So they were there all the time. And we were kind of at the forefront of giving them these profiles this access to the world and the internet stuff that they weren't really privy to, being of like where they grew up and what they had been exposed to. Mm-hmm. And it worked like wildfire because it really exposed them to an international artist and gave them a presence that was non-existent in their community, and really helped set the genre and the bar much higher just because of what we were used to in regards to marketing, or what we were used to in presenting these artists. It really kind of opened up their windows of opportunity and really kind of set them apart from a lot of the other artists and people that they were quote unquote in competition with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just thinking, like, that's so amazing, the support that you provided for them. I think today, and you obviously can correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like a lot of artists have to bring, you know, their social media to the table now. Like, they're expected to have cultivated, you know, a huge fan base online before being considered. What do you think about that?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it's an incredible asset if it's really you and you're good at it. Mm-hmm. I think it can be very obvious if you're paying a marketing company or a social media expert to be helming it, where you constantly have this promotional mindset or these little gimmicks and games and contests and things that are happening. And some of them are very eloquent at doing it. And again, just as we discussed before, don't even realize it. You know, yeah. Like the whole DJ Khalid story, or Britney Spears, of all people, with like the weird stuff that she posts. And then there's some people just have absolute autonomy and mystique. I mean, you're never going to see Bono tweeting or posting or Instagramming what sandwich he's eating, or Adele or Chris Martin.
Not Coldplay. Yet.
And it's not because, and a lot of people say, well, look at their age, demographic. It has nothing to do with it. It's just not cool.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But some of them are very good at it. And if you're good at it, like I said, it's an incredible asset mm-hmm. to have. But I personally don't think it's the be-all, end-all, because when we had worked with Adele, she didn't even have a website, no social media, and no web presence whatsoever. We saw through all that. We didn't need metrics or data or how many likes she had or how many streams or videos that she had. All we heard was her voice and her songs.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's been consistent with that. You know, she wouldn't release on Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So, you know, she's a great example of that. We're running out of time, and I wanted to get to what you're working on today about A&R Worldwide, and if you want to plug the Muse Expo coming up.
Well, basically everything that I've been doing in my entire life has led to this moment. Very much like a lot of other people or athletes or things, you end up doing things that culminate into something, and that's what A&R Worldwide is. So what I do, day-to-day working alongside our team is, you know, we discover and develop talent. And mm-hmm. Through that can mean a lot of things, from writing songs to producing, recording, mixing, doing all the brand imaging, and helping format, you know, what the release strategy is going to be as far as, singles or EPs. And then, a big part of that, you know, with the background that Sat, my boss, has, mm-hmm. is radio and all forms of radio, because we consider, you know, the digital service providers like Spotify or Apple Music as just being external radio partners, because that's basically really what they are, except for you could either create your own playlist or listen to a playlist, but it's essentially the same type of thing, same as Pandora. But with what we do is just expose artists to various touch points throughout the industry, from, you know, radio to film, TV, video game, synchronization, and also to various other forms of media, technology companies, brands, labels, publishers, booking agents. And as I'm naming all these things, I'm thinking back to what we originally talked about and all the little stones that I've walked on in my path. Mm-hmm. To know what all those various things are and experience all those things in every sense of their form. And that's basically what we do at A&R Worldwide is market and break these artists on a global scale. And, you know, we've been very fortunate to work with some of the best ones in the world. I guess I can name drop a few of them. I've been a part of working with our team with Adele, like to Temper Trap, LMFAO, Katy Perry, Gavin James. Fat had been early on with working with Muse, Coldplay, and Sia, and even like Dido and Jessie J. And probably more recent, like bigger successes would be like the band Shepherd. And we've all been a part of them from the early days before they got signed. And before they were household names. So we're very proud of that and lucky to be a part of their initial success. And Muse Expo is kind of like our open house of what we do day to day with our various relationships globally from all those touch points I discussed earlier with the radio and labels and media and publishers, and where we get together in a forum and have panels by day. And showcases at night with world-class emerging talent that gets signed.
Excellent. So it's like one big party.
Basically. And yeah. I highly suggest if you have any inkling of being in the entertainment or music industry, or even just a really rabid fan, I mean, the wealth of knowledge and unique atmosphere that Muse Expo is an incredible way to put your foot into the door and be exposed to the truly global entertainment and music business.
Excellent. All right, so one last question, and maybe this is like too much, but you have,
yes,
I'm single.
Yes, I'm single.
Yes, ladies, he's single. What I was going to ask. Oh my God. Here I was. I'm going to get all serious. I'm still going to get serious. So, you had this incredible experience with this magazine and being able to kind of like touch all the different parts of artist development and promotion and everything else and signing. And, you know, I think it's magazines are not, obviously they're getting a little bit in the dinosaur era now. And I'm just curious, what would you say to somebody who perhaps wouldn't be able to have that type of experience of immersing themselves in an environment where, you know, all these things are happening? Is there any other leads that you would share in terms of somebody looking to get into your type of work? Does that make sense? That was kind of a long-winded rambling.
No, it makes perfect sense. The first thing I would say is magazines are not dinosaurs, even though they appear to be disappearing in regards to like a bookstore or a press shelf or, you know, delivery to your door. I mean, ultimately, they're still filling up offices and doctor's offices. And when people come home or when they're sitting in their favorite throne in the restroom, they pick up a magazine. And I think it's still an incredible way to communicate imagery with the written word. It's still not the same feel when you're swiping left or right on your phone or Kindle, or swiping up on your Snapchat to read these abominations of advertisements. They're not even stories. And
tell me how you really feel.
the written word and people that are wordsmiths are invaluable. And reading and comprehension is so important to expanding your mind and your creativity that I think, you know, magazines are still important. They're still out there, and some of them are more online. But I guess after I just expressed my passions of magazines, how I would get involved in the industry and something like that.
Yeah, I'm just in terms of like an immersive experience. Sorry to interrupt you. Just like an immersive, an ability to get in a, like an immersive experience like you had where you were exposed to all these different departments.
I would say two things. The first, the traditional, if you're just strictly trying to get into to music, I would go work at a record label and don't intern for any particular department. I would start in the mailroom, just like I did, or David Geffen, or a lot of other greats did or still do. Because, again, what people in any industry really want to see is, do you have common sense? Do you show up on time? Can I trust you? And do I like you? And once you get past all that, the rest of the stuff they'll expose you to. But you got to pass those tests. That's what an internship really is, passing those tests. But at least through a mailroom, again, you're going to meet a lot of different people and see what you gravitate towards or who your personality gravitates towards when they start talking to you. And the other one would be, you know, would be interesting would be some of these agencies that deal with making commercials and are basically the people that are on the creative side of all the big major brands throughout the world, because they marry music, talent, and imagery with stuff that we see on commercials. So that's obviously an interesting path, and there's a lot of opportunities at various advertising agencies. And then the other one, as far as like where things are going in media and everything, is some of these YouTube channels. The myriad of them out there where they're signing and discovering not only artists, but also just YouTube celebrities. And they're basically developing them no different than the way a record label would or a talent agency, except for they're bringing in brands to integrate with all their, you know, signed talent. And that could be something very interesting, too, to not only get exposed to music, but also to technology and an agency all, you know, combined into one thing. But if music is your sole passion, just follow your heart, follow your dreams. If you're a musician, never give up. One of my friends who really is probably one of the most fantastic bass players I've ever known, have been trying for years in lots of local failed bands and everything, and now he's touring the world playing bass for Air Supply of all bands.
Oh, that's so great. But, I love that.
But now he's literally touring the entire world and living like a rock star because he never stopped playing, and he always kept up his chops and his look and got this opportunity, and now it's come to full fruition. So
that's fantastic.
Never give up and just try to find your way.
Thank you so much. Well, perfect note to end on. So, Monty, thank you again. And can people reach you at anrworldwide.com? Can they just go to the website?
They can email me at Monty, M-O-N-T-E, at anrworldwide.com. Or you can Google me or look me up on any of the social medias at Monty Malone.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes, a fantastic, really great interview. Very grateful to Monty for taking the time to share with us his musical journey and career trajectory. And again, you can reach him at Monty at anrworldwide.com or just go to the website A-N, so the letter N-R, worldwide.com or Twitter. And Instagram, he's at Monty Malone, M-O-N-T-E-M-A-L-O-N-E. I am your host, El Ariel. Thus ends another great episode of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Again, please like, subscribe, and share. Maybe give us some stars on iTunes and Google Play. Give us some love so we can get some more attention and help those that are looking to get a career in the music industry. You can reach me at L-A-R-I-E-L Music or my website, lariel-music.com. And I hope you have an absolutely phenomenal, fantastic week. And what are we going to do, kids? We're going to keep on hustling. We're going to pursue that dream. And just like Monty said, we're never, ever, ever going to give up.